Thank you, Vimladi.
And yeah, it's great to be here. So yeah, this is my first time in Sweden and first time in Stockholm. So yeah, really.
Ooh.
Yeah, woo. Yeah, it's great. I'm really enjoying it. And I've been very well hosted by Vimladi, who's been my tour guide today around the city. So yeah. Yeah, so what I'm going to talk about a bit is specifically what Karina door knocking appeals can do, the benefits of Karina door knocking appeals. Really, what I'd like is for all of you to come and do a Karina door knocking appeal. But failing that, I'm hoping that some of you will do. But failing that, what I'd also like to do is to talk about why appeals are beneficial as a spiritual practice, and how. Well, there's three areas that I'd like to talk about appeals and why they're transformative. And hopefully you'll see how all of those three areas can come across into our daily lives as well. So hopefully I'm just going to talk a bit about how we can apply, connecting with people as a spiritual practice. So, I think most of you, maybe not, but I think most of you know about the Karina Trust and some of the work that they do, because I think you do have a connection here at the centre with Karina. Yeah. So I do have some booklets here, which are the door-to-door booklets. We've actually got new ones, so I've bought some to show you all. So I'll leave them here at the centre, and you're welcome to have a look just to find out a bit more about the work that Karina do. But the main work that we're doing as a charity is working with disadvantaged groups. So we work with the Dalit community, who are the lower castes in India and Nepal, and also with tribal communities, and particularly with women. And this is in three main areas. So we support charities. We fund partner projects in India who work in gender, livelihoods, and education. And really, a lot of this work is on the inspiration of Dr. Ambedkar, who was a social reformist and politician, but most importantly to him, he was a Buddhist in India. And he, you might have heard about this already, so forgive me if you do already know this, but he led a movement in which people, thousands and then millions of Dalits converted from Hinduism to Buddhism to escape what they called the hell of the caste system. So he's a very, very inspiring figure, and the movement now in India, a lot of our sort of brothers and sisters who practice in Sri Ratna in India are very, very inspired by Dr. Ambedkar as a figure. And so are we as a charity. You know, Dr. Ambedkar is definitely a hero of mine, and as a charity our work is inspired by him. And really what that's about is about dignity and respect, and that any being has the ability to reach the potential of Buddhahood. So yeah, on the level of our social projects, what we're trying to do in India is to empower disadvantaged communities to escape poverty, access legal rights, and participate as fully as possible in society. Yeah. So the main source of our income as a charity is from regular donations. So about 75% or 80% of Karina's income is through regular donations. So direct debits, or you know, monthly payments, and these are recruited through our door-to-door appeals. So at the moment we run about three men's appeals each year and three women's appeals each year. And we have three employed solo fundraisers who are out in their cities throughout the year, knocking on doors to raise money. And all of this is done not just to raise money, but also as a Dharma practice, as a spiritual practice. And that's what I'm going to tell you a little bit more about this evening. So just to give you a bit of a sense of the size of the charity, In 2015-16, the end of year income for Karina was £1.82 million. Yeah. but yeah, that's just to give you a sense really of the about what size we are. So yeah, the appeals that we run, they're kind of like a retreat really, but in the world. And they're 6 week appeals. And we recruit volunteer fundraisers from within Tree Ratna. So everyone that comes in and does a door knocking appeal is a Tree Ratna Buddhist. So they're 6 week, they're residential. You live in a community, live together. You receive training over the weeks that you're living there. And actually it's all held in a very ritual context. So we come together, we dedicate the 6 weeks that we're going to be living together. At the end of each evening, after knocking on doors, we all transfer merits together at the end of the evening. And for me, appeals have been extremely transformative. So I did my first door knocking appeal in 2010. And since then, I've lost count actually of the number that I've done. I've probably door knocked on about 5 or 6 appeals. And then I did fundraising for 14 months as a solo fundraiser. So that was going out 4 nights a week in the city that I lived in. And then I've probably led or co-led maybe 6 or 7 appeals. So I've done quite a few appeals. And I'll just tell you a bit about what I've noticed and how I think I've changed through doing the appeals. So I've definitely become much more confident. So when I first did my first appeal, I was very shy and very lacking in self-confidence. And I've definitely, my metta has sort of grown. So I feel like my heart has just expanded more and more. I think I've become less selfish and I've definitely become less fearful and less anxious. That is true. And I've also just learned to be more with fear and anxiety and to know that that's okay, to not feel like I have to get rid of that, which is a real gift, actually. Yeah, so I'll talk about the ways in which I feel, how I feel this transformation took place. And I think there are these three areas that are transferable and we can all learn from. And I think this fits in really well, actually, with Buddhist Action Month. So some of you will know that June in Tree Ratna is Buddhist Action Month. And I don't know, I like to think that as Buddhists, we're like always active in the world and socially active. But I think Buddhist Action Month is a particular time to think about the impact that we can have in the world. And hopefully just some of the things that I touch on you'll be able to just go out and practice and see what effect they do have. So Dr. Ambedkar spoke about Shila or ethics as metta in action. And I really love that. I think, because in a way like metta, it has to go somewhere, doesn't it? It's not like we're just doing the metta bhavana and we're just doing it when we're sat in the shrine room. It's like it kind of has to be an expression. But I really love that ethics are the expression of metta. I think that's very beautiful. Maybe I connect with that because of my name as well. So kusala means skillful action and merit. So I do have a connection with ethics. Okay, so the first area I'm going to talk about is about doing things for others or altruism. And especially doing things for those who are in real need, who have a very strong need. And as we know at the moment, but there are many people all over the world who are in need. So when I've been to India, what I've noticed is that many people just don't have even the most basic needs. So food, somewhere to sleep, somewhere to live, health, all those things that we really take for granted. And there are many, many people living in India who just don't have those needs met. But yeah, I was thinking in this area about doing things for others, about the story of the monk who had dysentery, and the Buddha sort of visiting this monastery and finding this monk who was extremely ill and in a really bad way and hadn't been cared for by his brothers. And yeah, that the Buddha and Ananda sort of tended to this monk with a lot of care. But what I was particularly thinking about in this is that when the Buddha asks, well, why did no one care for this monk? And they answer, oh, well, he doesn't do anything for us, or he doesn't do anything. And I just think, oh gosh, that's, I think I find it painful because I think, oh yeah, that's kind of how we live in the world. We sort of live in this way of, in a society of exchange. So we think about, you know, what can this person do for me? What can they give to me? And yeah, well, I don't know about you, but I just want to live in a way that's less like that, actually. That's more about thinking about what I can do for others as much as possible without wanting something back from them. And when I've been to India, I do think that people in the movement there are much more socially active, actually. So I have a friend who said that when women in India are ordained, one of the first things that some women in India ask when they're ordained is, okay, what social project can I set up, or what social project can I work in? And I think that's just really inspiring. Like, they, you know, they join the order, and what they want to actually do is just get involved in society and really put their practice into practice in society. And I do think in the West sometimes we can get a bit more stuck in a sort of a self-development model, or seeing Buddhism as a tool for our personal growth, which is obviously really important. I do think that's really important. But it does have its limits, and in a way the Dharma is more radical than that. It's like the Dharma has like further reach than that. There's further we can go than that. And the Dharma is about all beings, and it's about human suffering, and it's about compassion and wisdom at the highest levels. So I can't even begin to imagine the experience of an enlightened being, but I know that it's really radical, and I know that that's what I want to move towards. Yeah, because of course essentially what that is about this turning in the deepest seat of our consciousness and seeing that there isn't a separation between self and other. So this way of relating that we're used to, where we're wondering what we can get from people, or, you know, that just wouldn't even come into play as an enlightened being, because there's no polarization. So why does doing something for others transform us? In 2011, I did an appeal in Birmingham, and there were four of us fundraising on the appeal, and Amala Vajra, I don't know if any of you know Amala Vajra, some of you might, was leading that appeal. And we asked if Sangha Rakshita was still living in Birmingham at that time, at Majumaloka. And we asked if we could go and visit him as an appeal team, and he said yes. So we had this appointment the following day to go and see Sangha Rakshita. And so we got really excited and like kind of started thinking about what questions we could ask him when we went to see him. And one of the things was that we'd all noticed doing this door knocking campaign that we had changed quite a lot, that we'd transformed over the weeks. And we sort of were curious about why that was. So we came up with all these kind of theories as to what we thought it was about. Like, oh, you know, when you knock on someone's door and they answer, you get reflected back. It's like whatever mood you're in, you get reflected back. So you have to, you know, you have to know how you are and you have to change. And yeah, so we came up with all these theories of why door knocking was transformative. And we went to see Bantin. Bantin's always been really behind Karuna appeals. He thinks they're a very, very good spiritual practice. So we asked him why. We said, Bhante, why are appeals transformative? And he said, so simply, because you are doing something for others. And that was it, and we all just went, oh, that's it. Like, it's so simple. It was so simple, and it was like, oh yes, it resonated with all of us, I think. Yeah. Yeah, because what we have to do when we're doing these appeals is put our own preferences aside for a bigger vision. And it's definitely not about not caring for ourselves or about negating ourselves, because on an appeal you really, as in life, it's like you do have to really look after yourself and make sure that your own needs are being met and that you're resourced. That's really important. But if we can go beyond ourselves a bit, then that is transformative. And for me, one of the most obvious ways that this came into play was there'd be nights where I'd have real resistance to going out and knocking on someone's door. It was like, you know, it was cold, it was wet. I just didn't want someone else to say, no, I'm not interested in your charity. And so it was like, oh, you know, I'd feel this real strong resistance before going out in the evening. And what I could do was I could bring to mind people in India, particularly actually I'd bring to mind a group who were called, they're known as manual scavengers. So they collect human excrement in a basket and they carry it on their heads. And they have to do this in the rain. They have to do it, you know, they do it every single day. And they don't get paid often. They get paid in bread. So they get bread thrown at them and it's stale bread. So, you know, that for me, it's like all I had to do if I had this resistance was just bring one of those people to mind. And the fact that our projects can transform someone's lives who's living that kind of life in India. And that would be enough for me to get out of the door. It was like putting my own preferences aside for a bigger vision. It helped me because it's like once I was out the door, I'd then connect. I'd see the beauty in people that I was meeting. I'd enjoy the moonlight. You know, I'd walk along and see the flowers in the street. But mostly I knew that I was doing whatever I could to try and raise some money for people that really needed it. And as you can probably imagine, doing that night after night does have quite a strong effect. So I think what it did for me was it broadened my vision, and it really works on my view that I'm at the centre of the universe, that I'm the most important person. You know, I think going out and knocking doors night after night just really sort of worked on that view. And of course, the more that we can weaken that view, the better. So the second area I'm going to talk about, so that was the first area, which was doing things for others. The second area is that what's also transformative about being on appeal is that you are working and living with others in the Sangha. And yeah, well, some of you might have done that or might do it at the moment. I don't know, maybe some of you have been on retreat, so you certainly have done that for at least a weekend or a week or maybe a bit longer. So you will know the value in sort of coming together and living together and in a way just having a common vision or common values. And that's really important because it's like, yeah, we can support each other when we do that. But also, I think what makes it transformative is that my experience when I live with other people is that I do rub up against other people. So again, I have to go beyond my personal preferences. Just thinking there was something that I didn't write down that I was going to say, and see if I can remember it. Yeah, well, I guess like when we're in the Sangha, we've made a commitment to, in a way, to the precepts, to open communication, to kindness. And really, we're trying as much as possible, we're trying to live by that sort of commitment. We're trying to become more aware and more kind. And so if you're living with others who have also made that commitment, for me what that means is that I can't just sort of hide away from that commitment. It's like I'm held to account a bit because others are also doing the same. And actually that I want to be that the best that I can be, that I want to just be my best self I want to be someone who's easy to be around and to live with. And I know that's not always the case. And you know, when you see that, when that's sort of reflected back to you in the context of working and living with others, it's painful, but I think it's painful in a positive way, because for me what it does is it shows how far away I am from my ideal. And actually what I think what the practice is to hold my ideal and to hold where I'm at, and for both to be there at the same time. And just being aware and sitting with that kindly, that hopefully something will move and change. Yeah, so also working together to help others is just fantastic. It's just a fantastic thing to do. So I'm not sure how things work in the Sangha here in Sweden, but I know in Nottingham, we really just do encourage people to, in the Sangha, to get involved. You know, if they have an idea, if there's something that they want to do or to sort of share with the Sangha, or a project that they want to get involved with, then we do try and encourage people to do that. Some of you might have heard of this term that Sangha Rakshita spoke about, which is the nucleus of a new society. So he spoke about a blueprint for a new world, which really is, for me, the vision of like a pure land is what he's trying to evoke there. And that sanghas can be the nucleus for this new society, that there can be a different way of living in the world, and that sanghas can kind of exemplify that way of living. So if we as a sangha are really trying to function on the basis of the precepts and in the love mode, it will influence the people that we come into contact with, it will influence the people around us in society. Yeah, so on an appeal, I think it's, you can probably imagine that that going out night after night and knocking on the doors and sort of feeling that resistance and having a lot of people say no to you, because many more people say no than they do say yes, but you do get used to that. But it's difficult when that happens. So then you sort of, you know, you get back to the community, and one of my favourite bits on an appeal is everyone gets back at the end of the night, and we kind of gather together and we share stories about how our evening's been. So you'll tell stories about the people that you've met, and the people that have said yes, they'd like to support, and the people that have said no and how they did that. And you really support each other in that way. It's a really beautiful time. So it's like you sort of sit around the table getting tea and toast and kind of getting warm and dry and, yeah, and just sharing these stories, and that can go on quite late into the night, because it's just, there's often either someone who really just needs quite a lot of support, or there's just such a lot of inspiration and joy that people just want to hear about that and share it. Yeah. And then we also then do a rejoicing in merits at the end of the evening, and that can just, again, that can just spiral on and on. Because people are so inspired. It's like, you know, they want to rejoice in Tim they met, who asked them in and gave them a cup of tea and then, you know, told them his life story and then ended up supporting the charity even though he couldn't afford it. You know, it's like there's these lovely stories you get which are just, yeah, very inspiring. So that's another lovely thing I think about living together, is like it's just sharing in those moments of inspiration and beauty and joy, and also pain and suffering, because you do also meet that on the doors as well. Okay, so the third area I'm going to talk about is a way, it's about building community, really. Or the other way I put it is about paying attention to the neutral person. So thinking in terms of the metta-bhavana. What difference does it make if we pay more attention to the neutral person? Yeah, this is something that just I'm really curious about. Because I think sometimes when I'm at the Buddhist centre or when I'm with my friends in the order or when I'm on retreat, it's like I do feel like I'm the best I can be. It's like it sort of brings me up to my best being somehow. And what I want to do more and more is just take that out into the world as much as I can. And I know that sometimes I don't, you know, sometimes I'll leave the Buddhist centre and I'll sit on the bus and I'll just sort of look at my phone and I can feel this sort of closing down and, you know, not that there's necessarily anything wrong with looking at my phone, but it's more like I can feel the contrast of like being with people, feeling open, communicating, feeling inspired or supported, and then this sort of shutting down that can happen. And it's interesting because we are social beings and we're in connection and we influence people that we meet all the time. And actually we have no idea what effect we could have on others around us. So there's two little stories that I'd like to share. And the first is a story that's not mine actually, it's someone else who you might know, Jayaraja. Some of you know Jayaraja? Yeah. So Jayaraja led Karen Repeals for a long time before I led them. At the moment he's the chair of Butterfield, so some of you might know him through that. So he trained me in leading appeals and also in door knocking. And yeah, so I've got he feels a bit like a mentor to me in fundraising, I think. And he often tells this story. He was out knocking during the riots in London. I don't know how long ago they were, like 2 or 3 years ago, maybe.
Three or four,
it's probably that. And basically there was a Karen door knocking appeal happening at that time, and he decided he would just keep knocking anyway. I think they all did actually, I think all the fundraisers did. They, you know, they obviously assessed the safety and all that, and they felt it was safe enough to go out and do it, so they did. And Jayaraja said he remembers he knocked on this door and someone opened the door with just so much fear. And of course, you know, they were in fear because someone was knocking on their door during the riots. And they opened the door and they said, "What are you doing here? Like, it's the middle of the riots. Like, the riots are going on and what are you doing here?" And Jayaraja, from what I remember, he said, "Yeah, I know, but I feel perfectly safe." He said, "I've been walking around outside and it's fine. Like, I feel safe and it's okay, and actually I've got this thing to tell you about which is really important and I want to tell you, can I tell you about the work that we're doing in India?" And what I love about it is that he said that the person, when it was like he gave them the gift of confidence, so when he told them like, yes, there are riots going on but it's okay, he said he saw that they relaxed, that there was a sort of response in them. And I just think, gosh, that's amazing. It's almost like he's going around knocking on doors and spreading fearlessness or spreading confidence or something, as well as the important work. And that's part of what I really enjoy about this job, is that that we can have an effect on the neutral person without it being the effect that we intend. And that's partly that's just because of our practice of the Dharma. So the second story, which is a bit similar, around the same area, about the neutral person, was when I was on a train about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, no, 3 years ago. And so I'd been in London working and I was going back home to Nottingham, which is about a 2 hour train ride. And I was really tired. It was like the end of the working day and I just sort of wanted to get home. So I sat on this train and I kind of like, was sat against the window, kind of huddled up a bit. And I was aware of this person on the other side of the aisle, just sort of one seat back, sitting there. And I noticed that he just seemed in a lot of discomfort. So he was kind of coughing a lot, and I noticed, I sort of looked and noticed that he didn't have any socks on, so he had his shoes on but no socks. And but mostly actually I think I thought he'd been drinking quite a lot, and I thought, ah, oh, I think he's going to like be sick or something's going to happen. Like there's definitely, there was something about him where I felt a little bit on edge around him. And so I sat there for this train journey, just kind of like, and really, I don't know, it was, I don't know if you've had this experience when you're slightly anxious or fearful, that it's like your awareness is really heightened. So it was like every little move he made, I was kind of like latching onto it and just aware, what's he doing now? Oh, he's got a bag now. And it became such this big story in my mind. And I think when I was younger, I used to have a fear about like vomiting, like being sick. And so I was thinking, oh, I'm sure he's going to be sick. And oh, can I be near him? Anyway, after about maybe about an hour and a half or an hour and 20 minutes, I heard him on the phone. And I just heard that he was very, very distressed. And actually he started crying, so he was talking to someone, and he was telling them something, like just what had happened in his day, and he was really, really distressed. He just started crying, and I just suddenly realised, like, oh gosh, I felt a lot of shame, because, you know, I judged him, and I'd sort of made him a problem in my mind. So I felt quite a lot of shame. But I also just felt a lot of just a lot of love, and I suddenly just realised, oh, he's just another being that I just haven't been able to be aware of and open to. So he hung up the phone, but he was still crying. He was crying quite a lot. So I thought, okay, I need to move towards this person. So I went over and sat next to him and just asked him if he was okay. And he told me that he'd been living in London, and he'd left his job as an accountant to move to London to do some teacher training, to train to be a teacher. And he'd stood up on his first day of training, or maybe a little bit into the course, and he just realised he couldn't do it. He was just overcome by fear, and he just couldn't do it. And it was very humiliating for him and very embarrassing. So he just told me this, and I just felt very, very moved that he felt able to share this story with me. And he also said, you know, I've got a problem with drinking, and my life in London just isn't easy, and I'm going home to be with my parents for them to sort of care for me. And I just felt like I really wanted to give him something, but all I had was some chocolate, so I offered him this chocolate, which he didn't want. But yeah, and unfortunately, because I'd left it so long to sort of move towards him, I had to get off the train, so it was like my stop was coming. And we sort of shook hands, but we had this moment of connection which was just very beautiful. It was like we just looked each other in the eye, and it was like in that moment we just connected. There was just, you know, nothing got in the way. And it just really reminded me of how many opportunities there are for that during the day, and how often we miss out on that, and how beautiful it can be when we remember to just pay attention to others and try and connect and move towards them. Something similar happened for me on an appeal, which was so I'm fairly organized, and I like kind of ticking things off my list. So there was one evening where I had a number of householders I wanted to go back and see, and just, you know, I'd made appointments with people. So that's what we do, is we read these booklets, and we just ask people, oh, will you read this booklet about the charity, and I'll call back in a couple of evenings. So I had a number of people who I was going to call back to, and I thought, great, you know, I was really organised. I had my list really organised, where I was going to go, who I was going to see. And I managed it was great, you know, I got round, tick, yep, seen so-and-so, tick, yep. And I got to the end of the evening feeling like, great, I've done my job for the day, I've done everything I needed to do. And I got on the bus and sat on the bus, and then I just felt really strange, and I just started crying. And what I realised then was I've just missed so many opportunities for connection because I was just thinking about my list and ticking the next person off. And it was like every door, I really saw in that moment that I could have connected with so many people then. I could have just been with them and given them my full attention and just connected. And I didn't because I just wanted to tick the next person off the list. So that was a real teaching for me. And it's not by any means that I remember that all the time, but I think more and more I do try and pay attention to the neutral person. Because of course, like most people in our lives are neutral people. It's like most of the people around us at any point are neutral to us. And it is just really beautiful when we can move towards them and make a connection. So yeah, I think the Karaniya Metta Sutta comes to mind. You know, we're asked to develop metta and we're asked to wish all beings well. May all beings be well and happy. And for me, what's a big inspiration around that is that we're asked to love as a mother loves her only child. I think, gosh, if just imagine, I've not got children, so I don't know what that's like. But I had a very strong connection with my mother. Just imagine if we could develop that connection for all beings, how beautiful would that be? So yeah, I think with the neutral person, certainly for myself, I noticed that I have a lot of fear. I feel like they're a stranger, they're different, they might reject me, they're quite unpredictable. But yeah, in my experience, when I move towards strangers and see them just as another being, then something really lovely can happen there. And again, as I say, on appeals, this does end up happening. You end up talking to strangers, obviously on the doors, but somehow that does tend to just widen into your life. So often if there's a team of us on an appeal travelling somewhere on a bus, we just end up just talking to other people around us. And yeah, I remember we were on a tram in Manchester doing an appeal, and it was like our tram carriage just, it was like people were sort of swarming towards us because we were just talking to everyone. It was really lovely. And some people that we meet on the doors do end up learning to meditate and going to the Buddhist centre. So yeah, thinking about my friend Gina, who's a solo fundraiser at the moment for the Karuna Trust. And I went out to support her on the doors in Ely, which is near Cambridge, a few weeks ago. And it was so lovely. We were going around knocking, and then she said, oh, I must just go and come and show you my new friends. And she had actually made friends with the people that she'd met on the doors. So anyway, she'd made these truffles for them. So we went around and she's like knocking, there you go, there's some truffles. And then she took someone else a birthday card. She knew it was their birthday. She walked down the road and she said, oh, let's go and see, I can't remember this woman's name, but she said, oh, she's going to the Buddhist Centre now. She's been to the North London Buddhist Centre. And it was just lovely, yeah. And actually, I know for myself, there's sometimes that people really connect with the charity and the work that we do, but they're just not in a position to give financially, but they really... Well, they might be interested in Buddhism, or they might just be interested in the charity, but either way, it's like they get something from the interaction, yeah. And, you know, Bhante talks about this. He says it's amazing the effect one person can have on so many others, and it's in this way that the Sangha grows. I really love that. So I just sometimes think, what would it be like if we were kind to everyone we met? Yeah, or could we always exemplify Dharma practice? So for me, when I leave the centre, instead of sort of sitting there and sort of closing off, could I just try and be more open and exemplify moving towards people? And who knows what effect that will have? It might make someone happy. It might mean that they're then kinder to someone else. They might see our example and want to be more like us. They might themselves want to be more mindful, more still, more kind, more loving. Yeah, so they're the three areas that I just wanted to talk about. So I'll just go over them again. It was doing things for others, living and working with people in the Sangha, and paying attention to the neutral person, or thinking about how we can build community in our lives. So what I would like to do is just ask those of you that do feel able to consider if you could do a Karuna door knocking appeal. So I've just got a sheet of paper here which I'll leave maybe on the table just outside, and it just asks if you're interested if you could just leave your name, phone number and email. So we do rely on volunteers at the Karuna Trust, and as you've probably heard, like, as a volunteer you can make a real difference. So you can make a difference to the people that you meet on the doors, you can make a huge difference to people's lives in India, and you can make a difference to the people who you're living with on the appeal, your friends that you become friends with while you do the door knocking appeal. So yeah, just a little bit of the practicalities around that. We do offer financial support for people, so we do understand that it's a big thing to take 6 weeks out of your life. So there's the details are on here, the website details that you can have a look, and just, yeah, on the website it tells you what the financial support packages are that we offer for people. And what we also do at Karuna is a telephone campaign, an upgrade campaign, which is where there's actually one happening right now in the office, and it's where, again, volunteers come together for 6 weeks, but this time they don't live together, they just come and work in the office in London, and they do that for 6 weeks, and they phone our current supporters and ask if they'll increase their donation. So that way we do manage to get quite a lot more money for people in India who really need it. So a telephone campaign is something else that you might be able to consider if you don't think that a door knocking appeal would work for you. Great, so yeah, I just thought I'd leave a bit of time for any questions. If anyone's got any questions about either anything I've said, or about the Karuna Trust, or about appeals. Yes.
Can you describe a typical day in a fundraising community?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah. So a typical day would be, firstly, it would be meditating together in the morning at about 8 o'clock. And the reason we meditate at 8, sounds quite late, doesn't it? Is because we don't get to bed until really late the night before, because we've been out on the doors and sharing our stories. So we meditate a little bit later at 8 o'clock. Then there's this morning period. So at 10:30 we start training, but before that there's just a bit of time for kind of milling around, having your breakfast, and often that period is in silence because the days can be quite full, there's quite a lot of input and they're quite intense, so it's really nice to have that silence and that space in the morning period. Someone will probably cook lunch in that period, so we have like a big meal at lunchtime, so someone will be preparing a big lunch for everyone. And then 10:30 until 1, there's a training session. So we do all sorts in that, they're really good fun, I think. role plays, so we role play how to knock a door, what that's like, any doors that we might have experienced the night before to see how someone else would deal with what they've met. Or that period might be Dharma study, so we'll invite order members to come and lead Dharma study for us. Or it might be more enrichment things like some input around meditation or some kind of movement workshop. Or something like a Myers-Briggs, a morning on Myers-Briggs types, and how that will affect how you are on the doors. So yeah, that's the morning session. Then we have lunch together. Then there's the all-important afternoon nap. So because the days are so long and full on, like, most people after lunch, they kind of disperse and just go to bed. but really, there is a free bit of time between sort of 2 o'clock and 4 o'clock where you can do whatever you wanted to do in that time. Then at 4 o'clock, we come together and meditate again, and often we'll do the Metta Bhavana then. So we'll bring to mind the people that we'll be meeting that evening, the people that work in the Karen offices, and the people that are in India as well. And then we go out, travel to whichever area we'll be door knocking in, and knock doors from about 6 until about 9:30 in the evening. And yeah, then you travel home, share your stories, rejoice in merits, and end with a transference of merits before bedtime. And that's the usual days from Monday to Friday. That's what the days look like. The weekends are free, but we encourage people, if they can, to sort of stay within the community for most weekends, just so that you can hang out in a bit more of a relaxed way, because obviously there's quite a lot of structure during the week. So, yeah.
How many doors do you knock?
It depends. Some people work much quicker than others, as you heard with my story, ticking people off. I'd say on average around 20, 25, 30 probably on average actually. Yeah. But many of those, if you think like lots of people don't answer, or they might be on the phone, so it's like a really brief interaction. It's quite rare to stand and talk to someone for a long time, but it's really lovely when you do. It's really lovely when people do just stand and give you a lot of time. Yeah.
Do you go out to in pairs or mostly alone?
No, you go out on your own. And yeah, so we've thought about this before, and yeah, we often return to this because a lot of people ask about that and about the safety of it, but actually we've been running appeals in this way for about 37 years, or maybe a bit more, maybe. And yeah, you know, people have been safe all of that time. And actually, for me, the most important thing about going out on your own is that you have to draw on your own resources more. So I think that's part of what makes it such a strong spiritual practice, is that in a way, of course we can support each other when we're together, but at the same time, you're not sort of drawing on your own resources quite as much. And I think that's quite an important part of it, when you're sort of there on the street on your own, and people have been saying no, and you're kind of, you don't quite know what to do next. You can always phone the person that's leading an appeal. So I, as an appeal leader, I would always have my phone on and be available if people wanted to talk. But yeah, you do it on your own.
What does people think when you knock as late as after 9 o'clock?
Well, we only knock the first meetings of people until 8:30. And then the second half of the evening is going back to see the people that we've left the booklets with. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So between 6 and 8-ish is like those meeting new people. And then the second part of the evening is going back to the ones you've already met. Mm. Yeah. It's very interesting. You get such a mixed response. It's amazing. You see the whole spectrum. So some people you can knock at like 10:30 at night and they'd still be really welcoming and say, oh yeah, come in. Oh yeah, I've read your booklet. And others, it's like you go at 6 in the evening and they're sort of really tentatively opening the door saying, what are you doing, why are you here, it's too late, I'm putting the kids to bed, we're having dinner. You just get such a whole spectrum. And actually what's important about that is that you realise that it's okay for you to be there, and that actually that person can choose whether they interact with you or not, and that's okay. And you sort of learn not to take it so personally, which is a hard learning, but it's an important one. Yeah.
But also remember that the day here is an hour earlier than in Britain, because everything is an hour later in Britain. Because we start work at 9.
Okay.
Yeah, the British working day starts at 9.
Yeah, 9 till 5 generally.
So
yeah.
People tend to go to bed a bit later than in Sweden.
Okay, that's interesting, yeah.
But what kind of houses is it like? I don't know what you call it, apartment houses that we have here in Stockholm.
Everything's locked down in
It's very rare that somebody ever knocks on your door.
It's different houses. Like, we don't generally knock on apartments, so we'd knock on more like either terraced houses or sort of semi-detached houses. And it's interesting because you do get a bit of a sense of the houses that might be a bit more open to someone calling at them or not. And it's a generalisation, but you get houses that have curtains that are wide open, that have like a really beautiful garden, and have like sometimes children's equipment that have like families and things. And I don't know, often if I look at a house, I can sort of gauge whether I'm going to have a good response or not. Because in the UK you also get different, you get what we call net curtains, which is like these sort of nets that you put over your windows, but it's sort of, so you can't see through them, so you can't quite see what's going on in the house, and sometimes they can be a bit of a sign of like, oh, don't know about this sort of, but it's always good to test that theory out. Yeah.
I'm thinking this evening is as big a lesson in British culture.
Is it common with door knocking?
Yes.
It is.
It's very common, yeah. Especially in London. Well, where we do the appeals in like the major cities. And in the major cities, you get a lot of people knocking on your doors. In London, there's actually a system set up where you have to bid to say, we'd like this street for this week as a charity. And they allow like one charity per week. So you'll get at least one charity a week, but then you'll get other people knocking on your doors as well, like trying to sell things or maybe. But in London, like, you can also get charities that don't enter that bidding system and they just do it anyway. So some people get like three nights a week, they'll get a charity coming to their door. Yeah. Yeah. So the thing about that is that they've learnt how to respond, how to say no. So they've got their response of like, I don't do anything on the door. And it's like, oh, okay, you don't do anything on the door. That's interesting. And then as a fundraiser, it's like, how do I then not fall into my role as a fundraiser of like, oh, I'm really sorry, okay, I'll leave you to it, and sort of trot away. It's like, how can I sort of see beyond that response to what else might be there? And it might just be that they're really cautious about giving out their details, or it might be that actually they're just at home from work, they want to go and sit down and relax and have some food. So it's like trying to see like what's the need underneath what they're saying there, and can I just like hear that and reassure them that I'm not going to take up a lot of their time. Yeah.
Do you try to say to them that can I come another time, or do you just want to go back then?
Well, I think what's great about the way that we door knock, which the way that Karen a door knock is quite rare, so to leave the booklet and go back is quite rare. What most charities do is they try and get you to sign up to the charity there and then. So when we're able to say, oh, actually, I'd like to leave you with some information, are you happy to read it? And I'll just call back and see you in a couple of days. Most people just go, oh yeah, that's great, yeah. Because that's actually what they want to do. They want to know about the charity, but they don't want to be stood on the doorstep and have a script, you know. It's like they just want to go and sit down in their own home and find out a bit more about us. So on the whole, I wouldn't say I'll come back, but I'll just say, oh, will you read that? And I'll just pop back in a couple of days when you've had a bit more time. Yeah. Great.
No more questions, or? So I'll just say thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
All this with us.
Yeah, great to be here. Yeah.